top, which was flat except for a small shed that contained the stair. His father gestured.
Arnaldo, you take the south side with me. Marco, you take the north, but stand behind the shed. Use it for cover.
But, Papa, I thought I'd be fighting alongside you. His father shot him a look.
Do as I say. Don't fire until I give the order.
Marco wanted to protest, but didn't. When do they arrive?
We'll see. War is waiting. Go to your post.
Marco hustled to the shed and took a position at the same time as his father did, on the other side of the building. The Nazis would be coming up via Ostiense from the south, so his father and Arnaldo were closer to the action. His father was protecting him by putting him in the back. But when the shooting started, Marco knew he'd move forward. He hadn't come this far to hide. He looked down the sight of his rifle, taking aim down via Ostiense. He visualized the Nazi troops and their panzers invading his city. He could scarcely believe he was here. He had sat out the entire war, only to fight after the armistice had been announced. Better late than never, Marco thought. The fighting began. The Italian army and its civilian volunteers seized the upper hand from the beginning, firing on the Nazis as soon as they marched up via Ostiense. The Italians waged a brave and bloody battle, and smoke and haze filled the air, the noise deafening. Shelling began, and soldiers fell on both sides, lying dead before the Castelletto and the pyramid. Marco kept shooting without hesitation. He ran out of bullets and was resupplied by a runner, though he became frustrated at his position behind the shed. He couldn't tell from his vantage point if his bullets had found their targets. At a break in the action, he raced forward and started shooting from the front of the rooftop at his father's side.
Marco, get back!
His father shouted over the gunfire. I can take a better shot here.
Get back! Follow my orders!
You said I could fight. Why won't you let me?
Back to your post!
Marco hurried back to his shed and resumed shooting, resenting his father for treating him like a little boy. He would be more effective if he had a better vantage point, as he was an excellent shot. The battle wore on, but the tide began to turn in favor of the Nazis. The Wehrmacht was relentless, their panzers lightning fast. The Nazis shot and killed wounded Italians who were lying on the street. Marco began to fear the battle was lost, but he fought on. His father fired like a machine with Arnaldo at his side. Suddenly, two Nazis burst through the shed door and onto the roof, forward of Marco. They raised their rifles to shoot Marco's father and Arnaldo, but Marco reacted instantly. Crack! Crack! Marco shot both Nazis before they could fire. They spun horribly around, jerking with the impact of the bullets, then crumpled to the rooftop, bleeding from mortal wounds. Their ambush ended in a blink. Marco lowered his gun, shaking with adrenaline.
Marco, get up here!
His father shouted to him.
Yes, sir,
Marco shouted back. The fighting continued, and though the Italians fought bravely, they began to lose ground and run out of ammunition. Marco's father received notice that the Italian army was negotiating a surrender. His father gave the order to retreat, and Marco, his father, and Arnaldo raced from the rooftop in Testaccio and hurried home. The Italian surrender was signed in the late afternoon, and the army was on its own. The government was in a state of collapse, and Italians hid in their homes. The defeat broke Marco's heart and his father's. The Nazis invaded the Eternal City, turning their fury on its citizens and looting stores. Rome was lost.
Chapter 75. Elisabetta. September 1943. It was a warm, cloudy morning, and Elisabetta hurried to work. The Germans had invaded and occupied Rome, and last night, drunken Nazis had looted shops and vandalized property, celebrating their triumph. Romans had stayed inside in fear, hiding behind their shutters. German tanks and trucks drove the Lungo Tevere Sanzio, and random gunfire echoed in the distance. She hurried past the bakery, where a few women had already begun to form a line. Most stores remained closed today, their windows boarded up to prevent further vandalism. Shattered glass and smashed flower pots littered the street, and tables in outdoor seating areas had been broken. Her paradise of Trastevere was no longer. Two Nazis stood at the other end of the street, so Elisabetta turned right to avoid them, taking the long way. They were everywhere, even though Rome had been declared an open city. Nazis were supposed to be confined to the German embassy, the Rome radio station, and the German telephone exchange. Elisabetta reached Casa Servano and opened the door to find Sofia waiting for her at the bar, wearing her brown dress but no apron. "Ciao, Sofia." Sofia crossed to her, plainly nervous. "I don't think we should open today. I was terrified coming here." "We have to open. We can't lose another day. Our budget is too close to the bone." "But Rinaldo's not coming in. We can't get another cook on such short notice." "Then I'll cook. Is Michele coming?" "I doubt it." "Then we'll bus the tables ourselves. Sofia, you and I can run the place on our own. But it's not safe. Who do you think will come?" "Whoever comes, I'll feed. People expect us to be open. We have a reputation. We lasted this long when others didn't. I can't survive if this place goes out of business. Can you?" "Yes, I have Paolo's paycheck." The answer caught Elisabetta up short. "Then we're in different positions. I'm opening today. Can't I talk you out of it? Why would you want to?" Sofia pursed her lips. "You sound like Nonna, answering a question with a question." Elisabetta didn't reply, disliking Sofia's occasional sarcasm about Nonna. Secretly, she would never forgive Sofia for selling Nonna's beloved china.
"Ascolta, Elisabetta. I have children. I left them with my neighbor again."
Sofia tucked her purse under her arm.
"I don't want to work anymore. I'm sorry. I quit."
"For good?"
Elisabetta asked, dismayed.
"But what about the restaurant? What would Paolo say? It's his family's."
"He'll understand. If you were a mother, you would understand."
Elisabetta felt like a mother to Rico and Gnocchi, but nobody thought that was the same thing except her.
"Okay, well, thanks."
Sofia frowned, meeting her eye.
"Aren't you sick of begging for olive oil from vendors? Of being cheated by the black market for eggs and flour? Of barely having enough gas for cooking and counting our matches? No salt for weeks? Tea from blackberry leaves and dried orange peel? Why don't you just give up?"
"Is that an option?"
Elisabetta worked all morning to make pasta, ravioli only, to be served with fresh pomodoro sauce, and Castelli Romani, the only wine. The dinner service was big and the mood celebratory, as the Nazis were gloating over their victory. Wine enhanced their mood, and they sang song after song. She was in the kitchen when she heard Hitler himself broadcasting on the radio, threatening that Italy would pay dearly for betraying Germany and that Nazi retaliatory measures would be very hard. Elisabetta grabbed a platter of steaming ravioli and hurried out to the dining room. She managed to keep the customers fed, the glasses full, and the tables turned. And after the last customer had left, she locked the door and hustled to the kitchen to clean up. She made quick work of putting away the extra food, careful to save every leftover scrap. As she worked, Sandro was in the back of her mind, and she felt afraid for him. The Nazis were worse than the fascists, especially when it came to the Jews. She started to put the bread away, but stopped herself. She grated the bread, collected some tomato pulp, rice, and cheese, then dripped some olive oil in a pan and began frying. In no time, she had made 12 supplì, wrapped them in waxed paper, bagged them, then cleaned up and left. She hurried through Trastevere and over the Tiber, and though it was after curfew, restaurateurs were given an informal pass. She reached the ghetto, which was deserted. She hurried to Sandro's house, raced up the steps, and set the supplì on his doorstep. She didn't leave a note because he would know it was from her. She hoped it would comfort him. He would know he was loved, even if he didn't love her anymore. And she wanted to give him that feeling, for it was all she had to give. She hurried away from the ghetto. Her heart felt happy and full. And that was how she learned that love warms the heart when it is given, regardless of whether it is received. Only minutes later, starving rats emerged from the shadows of Sandro's house, their noses twitching. They swarmed the supplì and devoured them all, including the bag.
Chapter 76. Marco, 13th of September, 1943. Marco tensed as a Nazi soldier approached the counter at Bar Girosport. The mere sight of the Wehrmacht uniform triggered a visceral hatred in him. The armistice had been signed last week, and it made Marco sick to his stomach to see Nazis swarming all over Tiber Island. Only days ago, he had been shooting them from a rooftop, and now he had to take their coffee orders. "Kaffee, bitte," the Nazi said, reaching the counter. "Danke," Marco shot back reflexively. "Sie sprechen Deutsch?" "Nur ein bisschen," Marco answered, meaning a little. He hit a button on the gleaming coffee machine, heating the pressurized water. Confusion had reigned today at Palazzo Venezia, with the bosses reeling from the Nazi occupation. Marco went in to learn information useful to the partisans. "Here," Marco said, switching to Italian as he passed the coffee to the Nazi. The Nazi took the coffee without paying. "You owe me for that." The Nazi laughed, then turned away. Anger flamed in Marco's chest. He caught his father's eye as he was walking toward the counter, his expression grim. His father had been listening to a secret radio in the storeroom, and he beelined for the counter, then came behind. "I have news," he said under his breath. "Mussolini has been rescued by the Germans. He was being held in the Gran Sasso." Marco masked his shock, in case any customers noticed. "He's setting up a fascist regime in the north. He's calling it the Salò Republic, after the town of Salò. It's a puppet government, and the Nazis are propping him up." "He's trying to return to power?" "Yes." His father picked up a rag for show. "Badoglio will try to stay in power in the south, in absentia, supported by some army officers." Marco felt stunned. "So there will be two Italian governments, competing with each other?" "Yes, and the fascist officers who had voted for Mussolini to remain in power have been released from prison, including Bonaccorso. It makes your activities with the partisans more risky." Marco's mind raced. "But I can learn more than ever before, too. Bonaccorso, trust me." "I know, but I fear for you. I can go on without you. I offer you that choice." "I'm with you," Marco answered, unhesitating. His father placed a hand on his shoulder, and Marco warmed to the touch. Neither of them had to say another word. The time for talk had passed. Now was the time for action. The Nazis infested Rome, presenting new targets of opportunity. Marco was ready, this time, to do justice. Chapter 77. Sandro. September 1943. Sandro felt intimidated, as he had never been to the offices of the Union of Italian Jewish Communities. At the head of the glistening conference table sat Dante Almanzi, the president of the union, who had formerly served as a vice chief of police under Mussolini. Next to him sat Ugo Foà, who was president of the Jewish community of Rome, also formerly a fascist magistrate. Opposite them sat the chief rabbi of Rome, Israel Zolli, with his characteristic downturned eyes and round horn-rimmed glasses. Chief Rabbi Zolli had asked Sandro's father to attend and serve as his legal counsel. Sandro sat on a carved chair against the wall, which was lined with mahogany bookshelves full of leather-bound volumes in Hebrew and Italian. A glass display case contained an antique silver menorah, ornate candlesticks, and an array of other priceless Judaica. Elegant brocade curtains flanked tall windows, which were open to the balmy afternoon as the meeting began. "So," President Almanzi smiled politely. "Chief Rabbi Zolli, it's always good to see you. But what is the purpose of this meeting? You called it in great haste, causing some disruption to President Foà and myself. My apologies, but these are terrible times for our community. Exigent times, in fact, and quotidian business cannot hold sway." Chief Rabbi Zolli shifted forward. "Roman Jews are under grave threat since the Nazi occupation. I have studied the matter, and it is my considered opinion that we need to encourage them to evacuate and emigrate. We need to disperse and disband Italian Jewry." Almanzi recoiled, alarmed. "What an extreme suggestion. I don't share your concerns."
"Nor do I," Foà added, with a deep frown. "What are you saying? Run away? We live here. Even so, Chief Rabbi, where would everyone go? Who has the means to travel or move?"
Sandro could see that neither Almanzi nor Foà were going to agree with Chief Rabbi Zolli, who had always been an outsider. Unlike Almanzi and Foà, born of storied Italian families, Chief Rabbi Zolli was a naturalized Italian from Eastern Europe, and his demeanor tended to be excitable, unlike the reserved Almanzi and Foà. Even Sandro's father disagreed with him.
"I can speak to those concerns,"
Chief Rabbi Zolli answered, agitated.
"I say we close the synagogue and our office, draw down our community bank account, and use the money to fund the safe escape of our members. We can also prevail upon the Vatican to hide more of us in convents and monasteries. We must act immediately."
Almanzi's lips parted in disbelief.
"The synagogue? Closed? What about services on the high holy days? We must cancel them. It's too dangerous to hold them. The Nazis could swoop down on all of us. We're too vulnerable when we collect in one place."
Almanzi threw up his hands.
"There's no need for such dire and unprecedented actions. You'll spread fear and hysteria. Furthermore, it would be unduly provocative to the Nazis."
Foà chimed in.
"Rabbi Zolli, you're panicking without cause."
Chief Rabbi Zolli frowned.
"I'm not panicking, I'm reacting. You're doing nothing."
Almanzi lifted a graying eyebrow.
"There's nothing that needs doing. We loathe the fact that we are occupied, but that necessitates no call to action. The Nazis have instituted martial law, so order is the rule of the day. We need to stay the course."
"No, we don't,"
Chief Rabbi Zolli shot back.
"You're underestimating the threat. Italian Jews are in mortal peril now that Nazis have taken Rome. I no longer feel safe walking the streets of the ghetto. Many of my congregation feel the same way. You don't need me to tell you about the deportations elsewhere."
Almanzi shook his head.
"Rome has always stood on different footing. We will remain that way due to the presence of the Vatican. I have to reiterate, I truly think you are underestimating the threat."
Almanzi hesitated.
"Chief Rabbi Zolli, if you must know, we have had assurances there will be no trouble from those in whom we have unshakable confidence, highly placed in government.
Chief Rabbi Zolli scoffed.
Then I am hereby requesting that we destroy the community's list of Jews resident in Rome. As you may know, there are two lists, one of those who contribute to the community in the graduated income tax, which includes almost all of the city's Jews. The secondary list is the index cards containing the names, addresses, birthdays, and genealogy of every Jew living in Rome.
Destroy them? Out of the question. Almanzi's hooded eyes flared.
Those are the official records of the community. They represent the history of our very members. Then I'm not asking your permission. No matter your disagreement, I intend to destroy those lists, close the synagogue, and tell my congregation to disperse.
No, you may not, and you will not. Almanzi scowled.
Chief Rabbi, you lack the power over any such things. Your jurisdiction concerns religious questions raised within the Jewish community of Rome. The actions you propose have nothing to do with religious matters. As such, they lie outside the scope of your authority.
Chief Rabbi Zolli turned to Sandro's father.
Massimo, is that correct?
Allow me to check.
His father motioned to Sandro, who crossed to him with the heavy briefcase, set it down, and unlatched the top. His father riffled through the files and extracted a sheaf of papers while Sandro returned to his seat. His father read the papers, then looked up.
Chief Rabbi Zolli, President Almanzi, and President Foa are correct. They retain authority over governance and administrative matters such as these. You have authority only on religious questions.
Chief Rabbi Zolli returned his attention to President Almanzi and President Foa.
Nevertheless, would you stand on such a legal technicality against me? I am the leader of my congregation. Loyally distinctions should not overrule my opinion.
Again, we disagree.
Almanzi's mouth set in a firm line.
In times like these, we need to keep a cool head. We need to communicate confidence and self-assurance. We will survive the occupation, as we have always survived, as a community. But this meeting is over.
On Saturday morning, Sandro and his father filed into the synagogue amid a throng of male congregants, their heads covered with white cappellini, or skull caps, and their shoulders draped with white tallit, or prayer shawls. The service was about to begin, and his mother and Rosa climbed the steps to the women's balconies, while Sandro and his father went to their seats on the main floor. His father greeted his friends, and Sandro looked around the synagogue with new eyes. His gaze took in the white marble columns at the bima, the gold brocade curtain over the ark that held the sacred Torah scrolls, and the ornate brass chandelier shedding a gentle light. Above them all was the square dome, with its vault painted a rainbow of gorgeous colors, culminating in a glass window to the sky. The beautiful synagogue embodied the peace that Sandro had newly found in Judaism like a healing salve. Before they sat down, his father took Sandro aside.
I have bad news. There's a substitute rabbi today.
Where's Chief Rabbi Zolli?
Nobody knows.
Is he sick?
No, his father answered gravely. He's gone into hiding.
Chapter 78. Marco, September 1943.
Marco, come.
Marco's father motioned to him, entering the bar from the side door. The place had just closed, and his father had been meeting with the partisans.
What's going on?
Marco left the counter and followed him into the storeroom, where they shut the door.
Look.
His father took off his backpack and extracted a cascade of tangled iron, which looked like a bunch of junk. He disentangled a large iron thing from the pile and held it up.
What's that? A quattro punto. A four-pointed nail. It's made of two long iron nails bent in half and soldered together, with a sharpened point on each end.
What does it do?
It pops tires. If you throw it onto a road, one sharp point will always stick up. It always rests on three other points, like a tripod. It's primitive but effective. It was used by the Roman army. We used it in the Great War, but I'd forgotten about it.
It's so simple.
Marco tested the sharpness of the spike with his finger. It pricked him instantly, drawing a bubble of blood. After the Battle of Porta San Paolo, one of our fighters, Lindoro Boccanera, was hiding in the military museum there. He noticed an exhibition of artifacts from the Great War, including the Quattropunto. He proposed we resume its production.
Where did you get these?
From a farrier in Trastevere. He's making them for us.
Trastevere.
Marco got distracted, thinking of Elisabetta. He would always associate her with the neighborhood, which he now avoided.
Next we strike.
His father fell silent when the door opened, then they both looked over. His mother stood in the threshold, her hair in mild disarray from cleaning the kitchen. Her mood had steadily improved, though Marco sensed she would never be the same. His father had told him that she had realized they were partisans after Porta San Paolo, but she would turn a blind eye. Marco didn't think she looked blind right now. His father said,
Maria, please close the door.
Don't tell me what to do in my own house.
His mother regarded them with a cold stare.
What's that junk on my floor?
Quattro punti.
Weapons?
Yes. Her dark eyes narrowed.
You planning something new?
Yes. She pursed her lips.
Beppe, if anything happens to Marco, don't come home.
I understand, his father said matter-of-factly.
Ever again.
I know. His mother closed the door without another word. Marco had to smile.
She doesn't mean that, does she?
Yes.
No, she doesn't.
You don't know her like I do.
What would she do if you came home without me? Would she leave you?
No, she would kill me. His father chuckled, but Marco couldn't let the joke pass, thinking about his father's infidelity.
Papa, what happened with you and Elisabetta's mother?
His father's face fell. I'm not proud of that.
How did it happen?
It began with Ludovico, Elisabetta's father. She was just a baby then, like you. His father eased onto a stack of boxes, setting the quattro punte on the floor. I met Ludovico when he came to the Piazza San Bartolomeo all'Isola to paint the basilica. He was very talented, and I would bring him coffee. And one day on his way home, he painted over the party emblem on a wall in Trastevere. He covered it with a perfect painting of the basilica.
Oh, no.
His father's expression darkened. You know, in those days, thugs abounded. Carmine Vecchio was one of them. Marco's ears perked up.
The Ovra officer?
Yes. He saw the painting, but didn't know who had done it. He asked me if anyone came to paint the basilica, but I told him no. That night I warned Ludovico to get out of town. That's when I met Serafina and I fell in love. Marco felt uncomfortable, as it was hard to hear.
Real love?
I wouldn't have strayed for less. But she wasn't who I thought she was. She was selfish. Now I know better. I know how lucky I am.
And you and Mum are happy?
Yes. Marriage is hard work, but it's worth it. His father smiled, his relief plain. Anyway, I told Ludovico and Serafina to get out of town, but he came back early and was ambushed. I suspected Carmine and Stefano Pretianni, but I could never prove it. They crushed his hands so he couldn't paint again. It was cruel and unjust.
Marco shuddered. So it had been true, what the ginger had told Elisabetta. Were they punished?
No, they were promoted.
His father shook his head.
Ludovico spiraled down after that. Couldn't paint, couldn't earn money. He started drinking. I gave him what I could. I couldn't stop thinking about Serafina. That's when it began.
His father pursed his lips, but held Marco's gaze.
I'm ashamed to say that I betrayed him and your mother.
How did she find out?
She followed me one night with a knife.
Mamma, a knife? Marco asked in disbelief.
Make no mistake about her. She's quite something, your mother.
She was protecting her family. His father heaved a sigh that filled his big chest. I made a terrible mistake. I broke her heart. I'll spend the rest of my life making it up to her.
How did Elisabetta's father find out? He's the one who told me.
Ludovico. Serafina probably told him. It wasn't her first affair. I heard she left him for someone else. He probably blamed me for everything, and I accept that. It's in the past.
Marco couldn't agree. No, it's not.
Yes, it is. If it were, it wouldn't have mattered to you if I saw Elisabetta. You didn't want me to see her because she was Serafina's daughter. That's why you hit me at Aldo's funeral, isn't it?
Your past became my present, Papa.
His father cringed. You're right. I was embarrassed that you knew.
So you understood me?
Of course. You could never hide your feelings. From when you were little, I could see hate in your eyes, disrespect for me.
Marco felt a rush of love for his father. Not anymore. He smiled.
As for Elisabetta, you're better off without her.
Marco couldn't stay silent. No, Papa. I'm not.
Chapter 79. Massimo. 26th of September, 1943. It was Sunday evening, and Massimo masked his nervousness as he got out of the car with Presidents Almansi and Foa. They had been summoned by Lieutenant Colonel Herbert Kepler, head of the SS in Rome, to a meeting at Villa Wolkonski, a historic Italian estate in the southeast of the city, which was now serving as the German embassy. Almansi and Foa had asked Massimo to accompany them as counsel, but none of them knew the purpose of the meeting. Guards escorted them onto the property, and Massimo passed a massive Nazi banner with a black swastika against a field of blood red. Dread filled him, but he reminded himself to remain calm. The men were escorted along a stone path to the massive villa, which had been the residence of the British ambassador before the war. The grounds were beautifully landscaped, and Massimo hated to see this Roman jewel in Nazi hands. Set on the Esquiline Hill, Villa Wolkonski was said to encompass 5 verdant hectares. Waning sunlight filtered through the fronds of its many palm trees, and the fragrance of lemon and lime trees scented the air. 30-odd bays of a Roman aqueduct built by the Emperor Claudius stood in the distance, and Villa Wolkonski itself lay ahead, a magnificent home with squared wings, classic balustrades, and a porticoed entrance. They reached the entrance, a grand door flanked by Nazi soldiers, then were escorted into an elegant office dominated by an ornately carved antique desk with upholstered chairs in front. Massimo felt his heart begin to hammer when Lieutenant Colonel Kepler rose from behind the desk and strode toward them. The Nazi was fearsome in his gray uniform, its black collar embroidered with the runic SS insignia. He looked to be in his 40s, with a widow's peak in his light brown hair, framing a wide face with large eyes. He had a straight nose, thin lips set in a strong jaw, and a scar that creased in his left cheek.
"Good evening, gentlemen."
Lieutenant Colonel Kepler extended a hand, and Foa shook it with a nod.
"I am President Foa. Good evening. Thank you for coming. It's good for us to meet face to face. Please introduce me to your colleagues."
Foa made the introductions. Then Kepler shook hands with Almansi and Massimo, who felt a tingle of disgust at the Nazi's touch. Kepler gestured to the chairs opposite his desk.
"Please sit down."
Foa, Almansi, and Massimo did so, and Kepler seated himself behind the desk. A Nazi flag stood behind the desk chair, next to walnut shelves lined with books.
"Gentlemen, I regret any inconvenience this may have caused your schedules."
Foa nodded.
"We were pleased to oblige. If you would, first provide me some background. How many Jews are there in Rome?"
"About 12,000, Foa answered.
"There are maybe 50,000 Jews in Italy as a whole." "I thought there were more in Rome."
Kepler cocked his head.
"Do most of the Jews in the city live in the ghetto?"
Foa shook his head.
No, many have moved away.
But the converse is true, is it not? Everyone who lives in the ghetto is Jewish, correct?
Yes. So,
Kepler's expression darkened quickly, like a sudden storm.
I will come to my point. You may be Italians, but that is of no importance to me or Germany. We consider you Jews, regardless of your nationality. Therefore, you are our enemy. We will treat you as such.
Foa didn't reply, nor did Almanzi. Massimo's mouth went dry. Kepler sniffed.
I called you here to convey a demand. We need gold for new arms. Within 36 hours, you will pay us 50 kilograms of gold. If you pay, no harm will come to any of you. If you do not, 200 Jews will be arrested and deported to Germany, then sent to the Russian frontier or elsewhere.
Foa and Almanzi exchanged horrified glances. Massimo hid his terror, refusing to give Kepler the satisfaction. The Nazi had presented his extortionate demand as if it were a mere business transaction, as if gold could be traded for human beings. 50 kilograms was such an astronomical amount of gold that Massimo doubted that the ghetto Jews could come close in such a short time, if at all. They had been left impoverished by the race laws under fascism, and conditions had grown even worse under the Nazi occupation. The 200 people to be deported could include Gemma, Rosa, Sandro, or himself. His neighbors, friends, or clients, his community, anyone.
Kepler broke the silence.
Gentlemen, if you have no questions, you may go.
Foa cleared his throat.
I have a question or two. When does the time begin to run on the 36 hours?
Now.
Foa recoiled, aghast.
Colonel Kepler, it will be impossible to find that much gold in such a short time. Isn't there any way you can extend the deadline?
It depends.
Kepler leaned back in his chair.
If I perceive that you are proceeding with dispatch, I may be flexible. I may also be able to provide you with cars and light trucks to transport the gold in a secure fashion.
No, thank you.
Foa paused.
Instead of gold, could we pay the equivalent amount in lira?
No. American dollars or British pounds are fine, but not lira. I can print as much of your money as I want.
In the event that we cannot obtain the gold in time, would the 200 Jews deported include those converted to Catholicism or the offspring of mixed marriages?
I don't make any distinction.
Kepler pursed his lips.
All Jews are Germany's enemy. I've already carried out several operations of this type, and it has ended well so far. Only once did it not. That time a few hundred Jews paid with their lives.
Foa and Almanzi looked stricken, and Massimo struggled to maintain emotional control.
Kepler rose, motioning to the guard.
Gentlemen, this meeting is concluded. I will see you here on Tuesday at noon with the gold. Until then, goodbye.
Massimo felt shaken to the core as the guard escorted him, Foa, and Almanzi back through the gardens. He held his head high, but his knees had gone wobbly. The three men were led to their sedan, and they drove off. Nobody said a word until Villa Wolkonski had vanished from the rearview mirror. Foa, who was driving, spoke first.
How will we come up with that much gold? By Tuesday at noon, it's not possible.
Almanzi shook his head.
If evil has a face, it is Kepler's.
May I suggest a plan?
Massimo spoke up from the back seat, having gathered his wits.
First, we should work through the night, call our few wealthy members, and establish a donation center on the second floor of the synagogue. Second, we should call a meeting of the board for tomorrow morning. Third, we should make an announcement to the community tomorrow so everyone can contribute. We'll pull out all the stops.
I agree,
Almanzi said after a moment.
Good organizational thinking, Massimo.
Yes.
Foa glanced at Massimo in the rearview mirror. Massimo's mind raced.
We should also call Palazzo Venezia and the Vatican, too. They should be pressed to help.
I agree,
Foa and Almanzi said in unison. Massimo looked out the window. Darkness descended as the car sped toward the ghetto. The three men fell silent again, each left to his own fears. The task that had befallen them could not be more impossible. They had been charged with protecting innocent men, women, and children. They would try with all of their collective might, will, and heart to succeed. It was Sunday night. They had until Tuesday at noon. The clock was ticking. Part 5. I loved the Italians too much. Now I hate them. Field Marshal Albert Kesselring. Then one of them took my arm and looked at my number, and then both laughed still more strongly. Everyone knows that 174000s are the Italian Jews, the well-known Italian Jews who arrived 2 months ago, all lawyers, all with degrees, who are more than 100, and are now only 40. The ones who do not know how to work, and let their bread be stolen, and are slapped from the morning to the evening. Primo Levi, If This Is a Man, 1958. Chapter 80. Sandro. 26th of September, 1943. Sunday night. Sandro knew something was wrong when he heard hurried footsteps on the stairs. He looked up from his papers, and Rosa placed a finger between the pages of her book. His mother dried her hands on a dishcloth just as his father burst through the door. His sparse hair was flyaway, and his manner panicky. "Do we have any gold?" he asked, his eyes round with alarm. "Gold?" his mother answered, bewildered. "Are you crazy? Think, dear, we must have some. What about your jewelry, your wedding band?" "It's all gone. You know that. I gave my ring for the war in Ethiopia, and we sold the rest of my jewelry."
"We must have some gold somewhere."
His father rushed to Rosa.
"Don't you have any jewelry left? Something David gave you?"
"No, we sold my wedding band too. I have nothing of value left." "Why?"
"The community has to come up with 50 kilograms of gold by noon on Tuesday. If we don't, the Nazis will deport 200 of us."
His mother gasped, horrified. "What are you talking about? That can't be true." Rosa stood up slowly. "The Nazis want to make a bargain? 50 kilograms of gold? For people?"
"Yes, and there's no time to lose."
His father swallowed hard, his Adam's apple going up and down his skinny neck like a lift.
"We called Angelo the goldsmith. He says 50 kilograms of gold is about 12,000 rings."
His mother's hand flew to her face.
"Oh, no."
Rosa's lips parted in outrage.
"This is extortion, plain and simple. How will we ever come up with that much gold?"
Sandro said nothing, trying to keep his wits about him. He knew that the community couldn't produce that much gold in such a short time. Nobody had any money, much less gold. Since the Nazi occupation, conditions had gone from bad to worse. Ghetto Jews foraged daily for food, and some were starving. Tuberculosis was rampant in such close quarters, and his mother delivered babies that were stillborn. Everyone prayed for salvation, counting the days until the U.S. reached Rome, fighting northward from Sicily.
"Massimo, why do they want so much gold? Why now?"
"They need money for their war effort. Gemma, we don't have time to discuss it. We need to look for gold."
His father crossed to the cabinet near the beds, which used to hold the family menorah and antique candlesticks.
"But tell me, how did this come about?" his mother asked, following him.
"Kepler summoned Foa Almanzi and me to Villa Wolkonski. He told us the demand."
His father began searching the cabinet, which held his papers and their clothes.
"Massimo, you met Kepler?"
Sandro felt a bolt of fear. Kepler was the notoriously brutal head of the Gestapo, which had its headquarters across town on Via Tasso, where people were beaten, tortured, or worse. Everyone said that the screams could be heard throughout the neighborhood. Rosa stood motionless, her gaze terrified.
"Papa, how will they choose the 200? And where will they be deported to?"
"I don't know more than I told you. Help me look. There might be an earring, a trinket, a charm, however small."
His father rooted through the cabinet, tossing out papers and shirts. Rosa and his mother joined in. Sandro watched them, knowing the search was futile. He didn't know what to do. He was supposed to be a genius, but he didn't have any answers. He didn't know who among them would be deported. He knew only that Elisabetta would be safe.
Sandro, help us, his mother snapped. Hurry!
Chapter 81. Sandro. 27th of September, 1943. Monday morning. By the next morning, the news of the Nazi demand for gold had spread, and the ghetto was gripped by panic. President Foa, President Almanzi, and Sandro's father had called families all night asking for contributions. They'd also solicited Rome's municipal government, but it had declined. A crowd of families filled the piazza outside the synagogue, waiting for the doors to open and ready to give what little gold they had. Inside, the synagogue buzzed with activity. Foa and Almanzi kept phoning for contributions in their offices, and Sandro and his father set up a collection station in the Sala del Consiglio. They moved the conference table so the donors would stand on one side, and on the other would be the staff, which included goldsmith Angelo Anticoli and his two assistants, to weigh the gold and verify its quality, and Renzo Levi, a ragioniere, an accountant, to keep track of each donation. Sandro's job was to double-check the calculations, and he sat at the end of the table. He arranged his sharpened pencils and paper in front of him, as if for the most important test of his lifetime.
"Let's start the collection," Sandro's father said, with an authority that his son had never seen in him.
The synagogue doors were opened downstairs, and men and women came upstairs and began forming a line to make their contributions. They were ghetto Jews, since they lived the closest. Fear strained their expressions, their clothes were shabby, and they held their meager treasures in clenched hands, purses, or bags. Some lifted Star of David and other necklaces from their necks, and others unfastened small gold earrings. One older man took a bridge of false teeth from his mouth to offer his gold fillings. Sandro's heart lifted at each contribution. Everyone around the table watched as each ring, brooch, or necklace was weighed, its quality noted, a receipt written, and the figures double-checked. After a few contributions, someone would ask how much gold had been collected thus far, and Sandro began announcing a running tally. His father greeted people in the line, and his mother and Rosa arrived to help. Sandro and the others thanked each donor, no matter how small their contribution, and the community was so close he knew the families. Ascoli, Sermonetta, Viperno, Piazza, Sonnino, Vimentani, Fiorentino, Funaro, Caviglia, Di Tivoli, Del Monte, Sabatello. Sandro had grown up with them all, and before the race laws stripped them of property and livelihood, they had been shopkeepers, tinsmiths, bakers, salesmen, tanners, and peddlers. They had gone to school together, shopped together, and worshipped together. They were his friends and neighbors, and it horrified him to think that 200 of them might be deported. The morning wore on, and the initial enthusiasm began to wane. The line thinned to a few donors, then to an old woman with a locket. Simple arithmetic told Sandro that if they collected gold at this rate, it would take them an entire month to accumulate the required weight. He stopped announcing the running tally, as the answers were intensifying their collective anxiety. The ghetto families had given all they had, but they had far too little. Sandro exchanged grave looks with his father, who stood with his mother and Rosa. None of them had to say a word, for the terrifying truth was plain to see. They grew deathly quiet. Their expressions fell into tense and drawn lines. The lethal deadline hung over them all. His father crossed to Sandro and leaned next to his ear.
"Chin up, for all of our sakes."
Sandro forced a smile.
"I have to go out, son. I'll return in a few hours."
"Where are you going?"
"I'll tell you later. Keep up the good work, and have faith."
Chapter 82. Massimo. 27th of September, 1943. Monday afternoon. Massimo reached Vatican City, breathless from the walk, then hurried up the majestic Via della Conciliazione. Crowds filled the massive St. Peter's Square, and among them he spotted Emedio, who was waiting for him in front of St. Peter's Basilica. Massimo telephoned him, told him about Kepler's demand, and asked for help. Massimo scurried to him, his tie flying, and Emedio hustled forward, his cassock billowing. They met in the middle and embraced, clinging to each other a moment longer, as men do in times of distress. Massimo released him.
Thank you for seeing me.
Of course. I'm sorry about your terrible trouble.
It's horrifying, but we're doing everything we can. Thank you for responding to my call, Emedio.
Massimo caught himself.
I'm sorry. Should I call you Father Terizzi here?
No, you needn't.
Emedio smiled warmly.
Let's go. I know time is of the essence.
It absolutely is.
Massimo checked his watch, and it was already 5 minutes after 2 o'clock.
This way.
Emedio gestured to the left of the Basilica, and they fell in step toward the Bernini colonnade.
I heard that Almansi and Foa have already petitioned our Holy Father for help. I believe they just left.
What did the Holy Father say? Will the Vatican help?
I hope so. But I'm not privy to that information. I'm glad you called me, though. Sometimes a back channel can accomplish what a formal method cannot, especially in Vatican City. Diplomacy is the watchword here.
That's what I thought.
Massimo hurried to keep pace with Emedio, who had long legs.
I would be grateful for anything you can do. 50 kilograms is an enormous amount of gold.
Yes, I know. Come this way.
Emedio led him under the Bernini colonnade. We're going to the Collegium Teutonicum, the German college.
Inside the Vatican?
Massimo had never been within the walls of Vatican City.
Not technically. The German college is on extraterritorial ground, like the German cemetery and the Holy Office, where I work.
Oh.
Massimo still thought it was remarkable, and they hurried under an arch, flanked by the Swiss guards in battle-dress uniforms.
So what's your idea?
I'm going to introduce you to Monsignor Hugh O'Flaherty. He's helped a lot of foreign Jews get to convents and monasteries.
He's even helped them move into Vatican City.
Jews live in Vatican City?
Massimo asked, astonished. They hustled past a small cemetery set in a grassy hillock, surrounded by spiky cypresses and graceful palm trees.
Yes, Emedio nodded.
We have many Jewish refugees living at the College of Cardinals. There are over 1,000 rooms in Vatican City, but only 200 or so are occupied. Monsignor O'Flaherty has also hidden foreign Jews in apartments throughout the city, where they live freely.
How does he do that?
Massimo hurried to keep pace with Emedio. They were heading for a grand stucco building painted a soft golden hue, rising 6 or 7 stories into the sky. 2 levels of vaulted arches marked its entrance, which was at the other side of a beautifully landscaped courtyard.
Monsignor O'Flaherty's rank at the Vatican is scrittore, a writer, but he does whatever he thinks is needed on his own initiative. Between you and me, I doubt he could operate without the tacit approval of our Holy Father. The Monsignor has cultivated a confidential network of padroni di casa to help him. Some 50 priests and theological students.
How does the Monsignor rent the apartments?
Under assumed names, backed by false documenti.
Massimo thought it was ingenious.
Where does he get the money?
From rich donors who want to help. He knows a lot of people in high society because he's an expert golfer. He even taught Mussolini's son-in-law, Count Ciano, to play at the Rome Golf Club.
What about the Nazis? How does he get away with this?
It's very dangerous.
Emedio frowned with concern. Kepler himself has targeted the Monsignor, but is dedicated. He even disguises himself for his missions, so we call him the Pimpernel of Vatican City. Massimo's heart lifted with hope.
He sounds like an amazing man. Do you think he'll help?
I can't promise anything, but I believe you can convince him.
So do I,
Massimo said, though he wasn't sure. They reached the entrance to the Collegium Teutonicum, where priests and nuns stood talking in small groups. Standing alone in one archway was a monsignor with round, wire-rimmed glasses under his low-crowned black hat, in a long black robe with red facings. Remarkably, he was built like a world-class athlete, at about 188 centimeters tall.
"That's Monsignor Flaherty," Emedio said, pointing.
"He's so tall."
"So are you, Massimo."
"On the inside, maybe."
"But that's where it counts, isn't it?"
Chapter 83. Sandro. 27th of September, 1943. Monday afternoon. Sandro checked the calculations for a gold necklace contributed by the Diveroli family, then thanked them and handed them the receipt. But there was nobody else in line. There were simply no other contributions. His mother and Rosa maintained their smiles, but Sandro could tell it was effortful. No one knew where to look, averting their eyes from each other. The staff at the table busied themselves straightening papers or brushing away dust. Angelo coughed, the only interruption of the silence. Gloom burdened the room, as if the very air had acquired a weight measurable on one of the scales. There was a commotion as new contributors arrived, and Sandro looked up to see that they were Beppe, Maria, and Marco. His throat thickened, and he felt moved that the Terrizzis had come. His gaze connected across the room with Marco's, and he could see pain and sympathy etched into his best friend's expression. His mother and Rosa embraced the Terrizzis.
"Maria, Beppe, thank you,"
Rosa said, wiping her eyes under her glasses. Maria hugged Rosa.
"We'll do anything we can to help."
Beppe's rugged face softened.
"We're deeply sorry, Jim. It's outrageous that this should happen in Rome."
Sandro hadn't realized until this moment how much he had missed his best friend. Seeing Marco again brought back memories of a better, sweeter time, of a past they shared, riding bicycles, horsing around in the street, and walking through Rome together from when they were little boys. His mother showed the Terrizzis to the table.
"Look who's here, Sandro," she said, composing herself.
"Marco," Sandro started to say, but words fell short. He rose, came around the table, and embraced his old friend.
"I've missed you, brother. I'm sorry this is happening too. I'm sorry for what I said that night."
"Thank you."
Sandro released Marco, touched.
"And about Elisabetta, I want you to know I never—"
"None of that matters now,"
Marco interrupted him gently, his gaze glistening as he squeezed Sandro's arms.
"We're best friends, you and me. We said it once, but I forgot our bond. I stand with you. We stand together."
Sandro blinked. He felt the same way, and he could discern a new maturity in his old friend.
"Thank you.
Here, take this."
Marco reached around his neck and took off a gold chain with a small crucifix, which Sandro had seen on his neck since boyhood. Maria reached for her gold necklaces, one with a filigreed crucifix and the other with a corno.
"Take mine too."
Beppe handed over a thick envelope, then took off his necklace, with a crucifix and a gold saint's medal.
"I'm hoping the money will come in handy if you need to buy additional gold."
Sandro accepted the envelope and the necklaces.
"Thank you, all of you."
Chapter 84. Marco. 27th of September, 1943. Monday afternoon. Marco left the synagogue with his parents, threading through the families, filling the piazza, clustering in distraught groups, talking and holding each other. His heart went out to them, and he felt a deep wave of shame for having ever worn a fascist uniform. He would never forgive himself for the harm and damage he had done. Suddenly, a black limousine pulled up on the piazza, being driven by a chauffeur, an unprecedented sight in the ghetto. Heads turned as the limousine parked, and Marco and his parents looked over to see none other than Massimo emerging from its back seat, his face a mask of urgency. Massimo closed the limousine door, hastily greeted a few families, then caught sight of the Terrizzis. He rushed over, throwing open his arms.
Pepe, Maria, Marco, you're here?
Of course. Marco's father embraced Massimo.
We came as soon as we heard. We saw Sandro and made a contribution.
Thank you. I love you all.
Emilio helped us too. Look what I have.
Massimo put his hand in his pocket and extracted a pile of gold necklaces, which dripped between his fingers.
These are from friends of Monsignor O'Flaherty. One even had her driver take me home.
Bravo, Massimo, his father and mother said, delighted. Marco eyed the jewelry, fearing that it wouldn't make much difference toward the colossal amount that the Nazis had demanded.
I have to go.
Massimo returned the jewelry to his pocket, glancing at his watch.
Good luck,
Marco said, managing a smile.
Chapter 85. Elisabetta. 27th of September, 1943. Monday night. Casa Servano had a full house for dinner, and Elisabetta had been busy in the kitchen from the moment she'd gotten in this morning. Her one pasta menu had become routine, and food shortages had grown worse since the Nazi occupation. Tonight they were serving spaghetti alle vongole, spaghetti with clam sauce, and she had made the pasta, cleaned the clams, and chopped fresh garlic, oregano, and parsley. The kitchen filled with steam, and Elisabetta wiped her brow, standing behind the dented cauldrons of boiling water, one to cook pasta and the other to steam clams. On a third burner was a heavy saucepan for clam sauce, the heat low enough to warm the olive oil, but not high enough to brown the garlic. Timing was everything. And Nonna always said that spaghetti alle vongole was a dish that only the best cooks got right. The new waitress, Antonia, hustled into the kitchen and emptied her tray. She was 18 years old, with a sweet, wide face, dark eyes, and curly black hair that she wore in a braid. She was new to Rome, a refugee with hands calloused from harvesting wheat.
Elisabetta, I need 2 servings.
Antonia crossed to the stove.
I just seated table 7. It's that fancy German baron, you know, the regular. Baron von Weizsäcker.
Elisabetta tossed 2 handfuls of pasta into the boiling water, scooped handfuls of clams into the steamer, and cranked up the heat on the olive oil, throwing in fresh garlic.
Right. He's here with another Nazi. You'll never guess what I heard him say.
What? Elisabetta asked idly, stirring the pasta with a wooden spoon. She could tell from the smell of the hot water it had the right amount of salt, not too much.
The Nazis are blackmailing the Jews. If the ghetto doesn't give them 50 kilograms of gold by tomorrow, they'll deport 200 of them.
Elisabetta looked up, horrified. Her first thought was of Sandro.
That can't be. Are you sure you understood them? How good is your German? I heard about it before, too. I thought it was a rumor.
Elisabetta hadn't heard a thing, having been inside all day.